It's Thursday, April 25th, 2024, from Peachfish Productions. It's The Gist. I'm Mike Pesca. And Harvey Weinstein's verdict has been reversed, in New York State at least. If this is a shocking development, then you are probably like me, which is that you paid a decent degree of attention to the trial, but also a lot of attention to the narrative of Weinstein's guilt. Oh, by the way, Weinstein is guilty. I mean, not according to New York State court, technically. But what I mean is, I have decided, based on a lot of reading, that the guy did what he is accused of doing. That's just the normal human definition of guilt. But technically, he lost a criminal trial in LA, and that's why he's still in prison. He's guilty of those crimes. The grounds for appeal were pretty surprising to someone like me, someone who didn't realize exactly what was going on with every development of the trial. So at issue were the many witnesses who testified that Harvey Weinstein assaulted them, but these particular witnesses weren't the ones for which he was being charged with a crime. Putting forward such witnesses is, or should be, the appeals court decided today, highly, highly scrutinized in a criminal proceeding. Some of Donald Trump's past victims, past civil settlements, will be fair game in his trial as well. There are very similar considerations in the case of both these infamous actors. Because what you don't want is you don't want a situation where a defendant is convicted of one crime, but that conviction is based on his actions in other cases other than the crime for which he is charged. That's the mistake that the criminal court made, says New York State's appellate court. How does such a thing happen? Well, one phenomenon is the stripping away of the rights of defendants. That gets portrayed as a good thing. It's something that we have to do as a society if we are to move beyond the old constraints of true justice. It's portrayed as a progressive thing because the goal gets changed from ascertaining guilt and innocence to a necessary movement, let us say. So I'm going to read to you some coverage. And this wasn't bad coverage. It does, however, encapsulate the phenomenon I'm talking about. It's by Chris Francescani of ABC News. The title is Weinstein's Trial Spotlights the Use of Prior Bad Acts Witnesses. Weinstein is charged with assaulting two women, the subhead says. Six will testify against him. And those other four did not have firsthand knowledge, eyewitness accounts, or really any knowledge whatsoever of the two for whom he was charged with the crime. Now, there are cases where you can allow such testimony to happen, only the Court of Appeals found it was improperly applied in the Weinstein trial. But I'm going to read some of Francescani's description of the fact that two-thirds of the witnesses testifying against Weinstein had no knowledge of the crimes that he was actually charged with. Quote, experts in sexual assault and victims' advocates say the use of so-called prior bad acts witnesses, women with credible sexual assault claims against a defendant which fall outside the statute of limitations for prosecutions, are an increasingly vital tool for prosecutors at a time when the Me Too movement is drawing forth long-delayed reports of sex abuse. Quote, they are 100% important, crucial, and necessary to provide to the jury that the defendant knew what he was doing, that this was not an accident, said Kristen Gibbons Fieden, one of a trio of Pennsylvania prosecutors who won convictions against Cosby, Bill Cosby, last year. Well, victims' advocates, they're sometimes also known as prosecutors, and we should note that Bill Cosby was freed on appeal as well, though not for the reasons we're talking about with Weinstein. Like I say, the Weinstein result was surprising, but as I argue in my spiel, I don't think it was unwarranted, and I don't even think it was dispiriting if you're after justice for all, not just justice for Harvey Weinstein. On the show today, well, I tipped the spiel. I'm continuing the thoughts I started just then in the top of the show. But first, Tracy McMillan is the author of a new book, The White Bonus, Five Families and the Cash Value of Racism in America. I think I emphasized every word in that title. So in the book, McMillan tells her own story, plus that of a few white Americans whose lives might not be easy. They might not even be what you'd call good. But McMillan argues they do benefit from whiteness. I ask McMillan about her reporting, and I also press McMillan on her accounting methods. Tracy McMillan up next. So you've heard me say, perhaps in an ad in the recent past, that first we make our habits, then they make us. That is a quote attributed to the English poet John Dryden. I believe he was the first poet laureate. It is poetic. First we make our habits, then they make us. Let's talk about the inverse of that. What do we do when we want to get rid of a habit? What about when we think our habits are, let us say, unmaking us? Enter a product I'm here to talk to you about. It's called Fume. Fume is not a vapor. It's flavored air. So what it does is it takes one habit that maybe you're trying to kick and replace it with a behavior that has the look and feel of that habit, but not the detriments. It's pleasant. It's similar. It's replacing a bad habit with a different, more positive behavior. And now with all orders, you could buy one, get one on their cores, which are their different flavorings. You could stock up throughout the year, these cold winter months, something to do, something to exhale, flavored air. So nice. And as a listener of The Gist, you'll get an extra 10% off when you use the code. Head to tryfume.com/thegist and use the code THEGIST for an additional 10% off plus BOGO cores to help start making the good habit that much easier. Thank you, Shaka Smart. In the spirit of Barbara Ehrenreich, to some extent, in the spirit of Heather McGee, who she quotes a lot in this book, the journalist Tracy McMillan is out with a combination memoir and, let's call them case studies, but deeply reported stories of people living in America today. The name of the book is The White Bonus, Five Families and the Cash Value of Racism in America. Tracy, as a journalist, tells stories through people, and she does that effectively. She reaches conclusions that are somewhat routed and rooted in economics. We're going to talk about all of that, her conclusions, her methods. Tracy, welcome to The Gist.
Hey, thanks for having me.
When you think about the problems, the issues of inequality and racism in America, as you do and as we must, is your orientation, just because of who you are and what you do, what I just alluded to, that you try to think about how one or two individual peoples are feeling these stories, and then you try to tell it through them, extrapolate through them these stories of national importance?
I mean, a little bit, yeah. My job as a journalist, right, is to use story to illustrate what's actually happening out in the world. So sort of, you know, I think of the work that I do as being about reflecting truthfully and honestly what's happening in our country. And the easiest way to understand that usually is through stories. And also, you know, as somebody who's done a lot of policy reporting over the years, you know, the only reason I care about policy really is because of its effects on people, right? And so if you can't explain a policy because of the way that it affects people, I don't know, like, why I would be interested in that.
So the basic premise of the book, and then I'll ask you to talk about one story, and then I'll talk a little bit about your methods. But the basic premise of the book is tied into the idea of white privilege, or tied into the idea of systemic racism. And if you just tweak that a little bit, it's not just that Black people are downtrodden by logical implication, it has to be that white people get a benefit. Some people call this a privilege. Well, how do you document that? How do you put a number on that? That's your attempt to document the white bonus. The bonus is a more empirical form of this concept of privilege. Am I getting that about right?
Yeah. I mean, the white bonus is essentially a subset of white privilege. You know, for me, and particularly as like me as a white person who doesn't earn that much money usually, right? Like, white privilege can just be, it ends up being this sort of like argument about who has more privilege and what kind. And it's very hard to grab onto, right? Because like, well, I have white privilege, but do I have class privilege? All that stuff. And I just felt like I wanted to spend some time really looking at like, okay, well, what concretely can I say that racism has done for me or given to me? And also, what does it take from folks, right? You always want to be talking about both of those things. But the more that I thought about, the more I realized like, I didn't really understand anything about the way that racism benefited me. I was pretty good as a journalist at talking about the way that it hurt people who weren't white, but there's this flip side. And so that's what the white bonus was, is sort of an attempt to try and dig into that.
So to take a social policy that probably occurred to people hearing this as we're speaking, redlining. Redlining hurts black people. It did not allow them to get fair housing. The housing they did, their wealth did not appreciate at nearly the same rates as white people. That is a detriment to black people. Is it then, do we say logically, ipso facto, if it was a detriment to black people, not having redlining was a bonus to white people?
Well, I think, you know, any kind of oppression or privilege, right, it's always relative, right? It's never absolute. And so if, for me, what was really interesting about this idea of the white bonus is that instead of treating sort of white experience as the default and the norm, and sort of looking at black experience as that is what's deviating from the norm, in some ways, right, talking about the white bonus is what happens when you, from a policy perspective, right, you sort of say, okay, well, if I'm coming at this from a non-white experience, like the average, what does white experience look like? Yeah. And from that perspective, white experience often looks like there's a bonus attached to it.
But is this conceptual or is this mathematic? To take redlining again, is the case, and if you want to choose a different example that you're more conversant in, but I'm thinking perhaps an economist can come up with a calculation that implies something like the total amount of housing growth over the years that was affected, and it's still is affected by redlining, was, you know, whatever percent it was, in the hundreds of percent increase. And that could either, of the 900% increase, either 800% could go to whites and 100% to blacks, or could be 600 and 300. And so perhaps some economists can say that the black punishment, the punishment that our society engaged in as far as redlining, materially hurt black people to the benefit of whites. But on the other hand, you could argue it wasn't to the benefits. That's the wrong concept. We just decided to, as a society, shrink the pie more than it could have been raised. So again, take redlining, take any other example, and tell me how a detriment to black America necessarily, in that case, becomes a benefit to white America.
Right. Well, I don't think that it's, you know, like by hurting black people, white people benefit. It's just that white people were given benefits that we didn't give to black people. Mm-hmm. Right. So it's not that, you know, we didn't have to do it this way. Right. Like we didn't have to do something where we denied benefits to black people and other people, like or immigrants or anybody, and then just benefited white people. That's just how we did it.
Right? Yeah.
And so that part, I don't think is sort of like baked in. But I think that, you know, if you're looking at, did whiteness advantage people, like give people access to advantages and opportunities that we didn't give to other people, in a lot of cases, the answer is yes. Right.
Let's get tangible. Tell me about the nurses in Pittsburgh.
Well, and Pittsburgh is such an interesting place, right, because it's sort of this picture of the Rust Belt economy that has made a transition into services and education and all that kind of work. And so I met this wonderful nurse named Katrina Reckenwald, daughter of a union trades construction worker on the South Side. So grew up in a mixed race, but, you know, heavily white and low income neighborhood in Pittsburgh, went through public schools there, and eventually gets herself into nursing school. And she makes friends with this woman, Jasmine Tony, who's her best friend. And Jasmine is a black woman who grew up in Pittsburgh and ended up in nursing school, right? So one thing I really enjoyed was getting to spend time with like these two women who have a very authentic and real relationship and love for each other, and talking with them about how they each see race and how that works for them. Right. And so in the book, you know, they were really generous with me and spent time like reconstructing this conversation they had in 2017 when Katrina went to Jasmine. It was like, Jasmine, you know, there was this thing in Charlottesville and, you know, my organizer's talking to me and I mean, does racism still really happen? Right. Over cocktails. And Jasmine was like, okay, like we'll have this conversation. Right. And sort of working through that talk with me, which for me was really powerful because I think that's how working class and lower middle class people often talk about race, because they're in often fairly integrated spaces, not unilaterally. Right. But like there's a lot more integration among the working class, in my experience, than there is among upper classes.
Well, the nursing school also depended and hinged on a scholarship. And Katrina's mother said, my daughter got a scholarship to school because she worked hard. I was like, did I work hard? Did I really fucking deserve this? This is the Katrina speaking. Like, I don't really know. That's the end of the quote. So how is it? And how did Jasmine work her way through nursing school? How'd she pay for it?
Yeah. So thanks for bringing that up. So this was really interesting, right? Because this is the sort of thing as a reporter, I wouldn't have known how to pull this out of them. It just came out organically. So Katrina is talking to me about how she got into nursing school. And, you know, she had gotten into college and was super homesick, came home, and she starts like working under the table at a pizza shop and then starts making beds in a nursing home at night as a certified nursing assistant, right? So she's kind of like just kind of bumbling around a little bit, trying to figure out what she's doing. She's real friendly and good with the patients. So somebody at the nursing home is like, hey, Katrina, you should really apply for this nursing scholarship that we have, right? Because, you know, we need nurses and, you know, our corporate arm will pay for your nursing school as long as you come and work for us for 2 years after. And Katrina's like, oh, great, right? And she ends up going and doing that. Now, occupational segregation in nursing is really, really strong. I mean, in healthcare in particular. So certified nursing assistants, very significantly Black and brown workforce with a smaller fraction of white folks. And the higher you go in the income ladder in healthcare, the whiter it gets, right? So nurses are much whiter than certified nursing assistants, doctors much whiter than nurses, right? Surgeons much whiter, and so on and so forth. So Katrina, right, kind of doesn't know what she's doing and gets sort of pulled into this career ladder so that she can start moving forward, right? Jasmine, on the other hand, right, Black woman. So when she was in high school, right, she'd been doing some job and her, I think it was her aunt said, you know, you might want to get certified as a nursing assistant so that you can earn like better money than what you're making, you know, at the retail shop or whatever. So Jasmine goes to the guidance counselor at her high school and she says, hey, I want to do this training. Could I take a week off of school without, you know, getting in trouble or whatever to do this training? And so the guidance counselor's like, great, sure, certified nursing assistant. Go ahead. Jasmine goes and does that. So you get to the end of the senior year and Jasmine's at a primarily white high school. Most of her friends are white. So the guidance counselor is talking to her friends about like, what college are you going to, pushing them to go, all that. And Jasmine goes to the guidance counselor and is like, well, what, you know, I could use some help going to college. And the guidance counselor says, oh, but you already have your CNA license. What do you need to go to college for? Mm-hmm. Right. And so Jasmine had to really fight for that and be like, oh, you know what? I'm going to actually like try to be an RN and go and do that. Right. And so I think this is one of those subtle things, right, that doesn't necessarily seem, it's not racism in the way that I was certainly raised to think about it in terms of, you know, somebody out there like in a white hood, but like these subtle cues about what you should expect of people and encourage them to do really end up shaping folks' lives.
Right. So this is interesting. So I'm going to the conversation that you had with Katrina was exactly the one I was having in my head, where Katrina was asking you, I guess discussing with you that, you know, she worked hard, she had a talent for interacting with patients, so did some of the Black aides she worked alongside who didn't get headhunted into a scholarship, plenty of whom was good with patients the same way she was. Was that really racism? That's a quote, I think that's in Katrina's head. It was hard for Katrina to agree unequivocally with what I eventually told her. I thought, yes, that was racism benefiting her, the same as it's often benefited me, meaning you, Tracy. At first, Katrina told me she felt compelled to figure out if she really deserved the scholarship or not. Was she white, good with patients? And then she comes to the decision that I was thinking too, which is, fuck that, school should be free. Yeah, it's this weird situation in America where we need nurses, we need people to help patients and heal other people, and yet we present a gauntlet where it costs so much money to become this necessary healing thing. So I kind of come down on it the way she did, but that's also a way maybe of sidestepping the question. Is it racism? So there's one component like, well, the taxonomy of the word, and doesn't matter if the word applies. But on the other hand, help me think about the argument that you conclude that not just that Jasmine and Katrina's experiences were different and that it's quite plausible that if Jasmine was taking that job in the pizza place under the table and working in the nursing home, whoever spotted her for the scholarship might not have bonded with her, connected to her, seen themselves in her. All true. But is it racism? Is it racism is important to name that as racism if we have structures for people to help them in an extremely imperfect world. And maybe you could argue that it's more likely to be helped if you are of a certain race. I think there's no question about it? That's racism.
I mean, I think it's important to understand that racism isn't just discriminating negatively against people. It's also thinking favorably of people or opening doors for them or giving them the benefit of the doubt, which I think we should do for everybody, right? Like, I think that should be the default. But it's in our society, it often is not, right? And usually those benefits skew towards folks who are white, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's a flip side of racism. Because and there's really good psychological research about this, right? Most people have a really hard time in the US, black or white, talking about racism or even race as something that, like, how that works for white people, right? Because it's really uncomfortable, right? As a white person to be like, it's really uncomfortable for a white person in America to say, I got special benefits. These things that I thought were just the way things are supposed to be, right? Which is that I'm supposed to be able to get some help from government for school. And I'm supposed to be able to get some help from government to make sure I can afford housing and things like that. It's really uncomfortable to say, maybe I got that in part because I'm white. Not like a direct check to me because I'm white, but because people saw me as more valuable or more deserving of help, right? I mean, I think if you're getting helped in part because of the color of your skin, that's part of racism. I think.
Well, you're not. I would think of it as not getting hurt by the color of your skin. Like getting the full benefits of an American as opposed to some people who are denied those benefits. I don't see how that helps the people for whom America is working out for, and America should be working out for all people. And, you know, it's maybe getting there very slowly.
Right. I mean, probably we just disagree, right? Like, I think that part of the way that racism works in this country is that we give stuff to white people and we pretend like we're not doing it. We say, this is mm-hmm. just what Americans get. Americans just get the GI Bill. Americans just are going to get help with housing and education. That's an American right. Even though what we actually mean functionally is that white Americans get that. Functionally, that's essentially how the GI Bill worked. Not exclusively, right? So there are little exceptions, right? It's true. Some black people got help with housing through the GI Bill, but it's less than 2%, right?
Right. So, redlining in the GI Bill, to me, that was racist. A scholarship that one person gets plausibly because someone sees in her themselves and the person doing the recognition is white, as is the recipient. There is a racial component, but I don't know that that helps, that racism helped her. I just think that America hasn't lived up to its ideals. And in some ways, it punishes black people to the benefit of whites. But in some ways, it just punishes black people to the detriment of whites. Like the incarceration problem doesn't really help white people to have so many black people who are no longer a danger in jail that white people have to pay for through taxes and through the ripple effects of what that does to the black community.
I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I also think, you know, if you spend some time thinking about, well, from like black experience, like in the US compared to black experience, white folks do look like we get a bonus, right? Like mm-hmm. we get things. I mean, for instance, right, when we're talking about criminal justice, right? I have a profile in the book about Jared Bundy, right? Who is this like teenager in the 90s who goes and deals LSD at school, right? Gets caught and then ends up with extortion and larceny charges when he tries to like mess with the snitch, right? And he gets a second chance.
Right.
Right. I think he should get a second chance. Right? I think any 17-year-old that makes those kinds of ridiculous decisions, right, deserves to get checked, right, to get them to correct their path, but deserves a second chance. Absolutely. But I think that part of the way that racism works, right, is being willing to see that goodness and that potential in a white kid that you wouldn't in a black kid. Right.
Yes,
and the statistics on that are really, really strong. Right. So like at the time Jared was going through that system, right, 2/3 of the kids who were in drug court were white and about 1/3 were black. And then if you looked at who got sent to adult court, the numbers switch. Right. It's about 2/3 of the people sent to adult court were black and 1/3 were white. right? And so I think you can see in that sort of comparison, right, how being white is sort of like a buoy for folks, right? And helps sort of get them get across. So, I mean,
That's all true. By the way, what was Jared's class background?
Jared was like lower middle class kid. So his dad was an engineer and his mom worked in the post office. They had divorced, right? So his dad, right, they had this sort of split income set up and going between those. And certainly like they had enough money for everything, but there wasn't a lot of extra to go.
How much did that factor in, would you say? Say middle class, black, hard to know, hard to run the experiment.
I mean,
it's definitely true that a kid growing up, black kid growing up in the housing projects is not getting that second chance, especially at that time.
Right. And the class background for Jared's family, right, I think did matter in that he had two parents who were stably employed enough that they could take work off and show up at every hearing and like come, like show up dressed in a suit, like at every hearing, right? They showed up. Like the lawyer was like, you guys got to come and show up for your kid and do this. And then you start looking at, well, like, how did they get a lawyer that could help them like that? Well, that the dad was able to do that. He was unemployed at the time that Jared like got into trouble, but he had a 401k, was able to take some money out of that. And he had that job because, you know, he had this, he was an engineer. He's got like, I think he has a master's, right, in some sort of engineering thing. He'd been able to get that education because he had initially worked at Kodak, like in upstate New York. And then if you go and you look at Kodak's history at that time, it was going through multiple rounds of employment discrimination lawsuits, right? And so there are these things where, you know, I go back and forth about, like we call it the cash value of racism, because I think you want to be able to talk about the costs of racism, which hit everybody, including, I mean, they hit people of color the hardest, but they also hit white folks, right? So like Heather McGee is very good on that. But certainly like the cash value of whiteness, right? If we're talking about that, that was really helpful to Jared's family, right? Because his dad had this job and was able to get this education. So then he's able to like support his kid. So then he's able to show up in court for the kid and get a lawyer.
Okay, there's a little fade out. You got the full interview. We denied you nothing, but there was more. I talked to these fascinating guests, sometimes in, I'm not going to say confrontational, but a challenging manner. And you, should you be so inclined, are invited to listen in to more of that. That is what we call Pesca Plus. You can also subscribe just to be free of the ads, free of ads, I say. Go help the show. It's a small amount per annum or month to try out the service. We do have a tryout availability, and I would beseech you to go to subscribe.mikepesca.com to learn more. And now the spiel. Augustin Sandoval was a dope dealer, according to the New York Daily News, and a murderer, according to the New York court system. He was tried and convicted in the early 1970s. I could not find much else on the actual Augustin Sandoval. There is an Augustin Sandoval who's a world-class trumpeter from Mexico. That's not our guy. There's another Augustin Sandoval who was a Spanish gymnast who participated in the 1972 Olympics. Also not our Augustin Sandoval. Despite the dearth of biographical data on the Augustin Sandoval in question, there is an extensive record in the New York State legal system about our particular Augustin Sandoval. And at his murder trial, the prosecution was keen to let the jury know most of it. They wanted to introduce evidence about a 1960 charge of contributing to the delinquency of a minor, 1963 and 1965 convictions of driving while intoxicated, 1965 arrests for felonious assault resulting in dismissal, a 1965 traffic violation, and a 1967 charge of gambling. But the court would not allow those charges, those crimes, sometimes those convictions, to be relayed to the jury. The court, however, did allow some of Sandoval's convictions, such as the 1964 disorderly conduct and the 65 conviction of assault in the third degree. And they also decreed that the prosecution could inquire as to the underlying facts with respect to either of those conditions. The issue was, as the court put it, a balance between the probative value of such proof and the danger of prejudice when it is presented to the accused. In other words, a lot of misdeeds in the past, they could have just shown that Sandoval was a bad dude, not the particular good or bad dude who did this particular crime. The courts did not want to allow irrelevant information, which just besmirched his characters. But they did say if it was a series of acts which did a couple of things, like establish a scheme that applied directly to what the jury was being asked about, then that might be allowed. This all literally came up, I think it was 3 days ago in the Trump trial. Could they allow? They had a Sandoval hearing. This is what happens in New York criminal courts. Would they allow, past in Trump's case, civil convictions? And then they decide what could be cross-examined related to those civil convictions. And that is now, this entire question is the crux for overturning the Weinstein verdict. Ready? I say it's good that it was overturned. Good? How good? Why good? Weinstein's a rapist, is he not? He is. And I say this, as I said in the top of the show, not in just the common understanding of the sense. I commonly understand, because I read a lot about him, probably so did you, that he was a sexual harasser, and I think he was a rapist. There's a lot of evidence that he was a rapist. That's how we decide on things in the world. We look at the evidence, and we try to decide if the evidence convinces us, and then once we're convinced, we say, yeah, I think this thing happened. So that applies to Harvey Weinstein. I think he's a rapist. But put all that aside, he's also convicted in Los Angeles, in California. A trial there found him guilty of 3 charges, including rape. So you don't have to go through the whole metaphysical definition of what is. Sometimes for a principle to be upheld in the general, however, a specific defendant has to go free. And we don't like that. We don't like for the innocent to be jailed, but we don't like for the guilty to go free. It challenges our sense of justice. It is literally an injustice in the specific, even though if we're pursuing justice in the general. I bet that it's very hard for Weinstein's victims, not just the ones who testified, not just the ones for whom he was found to have raped, but all his victims, his many victims, to hear this verdict, to have to deal with the ordeal of public exposure to all the women who testified at the trial, to have to go through that, and then ultimately to be told, yeah, we shouldn't have let you testify in the first place. But like I said, in this case, Harvey Weinstein does remain behind bars. California state law rests on similar general principles, but is different in terminology. In New York, witnesses who testify about similar crimes, but not the exact crime, those are called Molyneux witnesses. And what could be admitted if a defendant cross-examines those witnesses is subject to the Sandoval rule. So I asked you to think beyond the specific case of Harvey Weinstein, because Harvey Weinstein was a bad guy. We know he raped, we know he assaulted many women, and we know this because there was more investigative journalism and quite a bit of jurisprudence spent on him, maybe more so than any non-murderer, I don't know, ever. I include in this Bill Cosby. I include in this just about everyone accused of financial wrongdoing. Weinstein was, after all, the most powerful man in Hollywood, which is the most paid attention to business in America. And undoing him yielded not just news articles and books, but feature films and many, many nonfiction films. So what I'm saying is, it's so thoroughly documented that he harassed and assaulted many women. That's not a question. And if it were a question, many courts have decided and ruled on it that he did this. Okay. Don't think of Harvey Weinstein. Think of a typical defendant. You know nothing about this guy. There was never a documentary, never even an article in the newspaper. So this guy goes before a judge, a jury, the system, and it's not arrayed in his favor. I say a criminally charged individual deserves exceedingly rigorous standards when it comes to introducing evidence of other crimes, not the one he's charged with, which could besmirch his character. They have the rules about this. I don't think it should never be done. It's not about what I think. It's about applying the Sandoval rules, and other courts have other standards. But in general, we should not convict people for being bad people. We should convict them for doing bad illegal deeds. But if prosecutors are allowed to introduce evidence which convinces jurors who are human that the person before them is so obviously a bad person, it gives jurors a massive amount of leeway to find the person guilty, not because of the crime, but because of the person. They might figure, and they might do this subconsciously, look, even if we're wrong, how bad a mistake are we making? Look at all these other crimes. Look at all these other misdeeds. We would be doing our neighborhoods, our community, our society a favor. But it's not how the criminal justice system is supposed to work. And a ruling like Weinstein's successful appeal makes certain that this tantalizing prospect available to prosecutors is not abused. And when it is abused, the entire question, the proper adjudication of guilt or innocence, is also abused. I gotta say, I was a little surprised by this decision because while I thought I followed Weinstein's trial pretty carefully. I guess I didn't follow it carefully enough when there was a debate about allowing these women to testify, or if there was a debate, maybe the coverage never put their finger and therefore my consciousness on how questionable a decision it was. I was under the impression that the courts had Weinstein, if not dead to rights, then pretty close. But today, the New York Times' Jody Cantor wrote a story titled, Harvey Weinstein's Conviction Was Fragile from the Start. Now, I was wondering, does she mean fragile in that it's very hard to convict a powerful person on years-old evidence that could come down to he said, she said? Okay, I get that sort of fragility. Cantor and Megan Toohey, her writing partner on this series, emphasized that over and over again. Or was she saying that the fragility was exactly what the court put its finger on, the use of these particular witnesses? I never got that impression at all. Outside the courthouse, when the trial began, Cantor's co-author of the series, an eventual book that became She Said, Megan Toohey, was interviewed by Dasha Burns of NBC. And in Toohey's analysis, the fragility was more a question of would the courts be stalwart enough to meet the social moment?
I mean, as much as the Me Too movement has been durable, the endurance of the fear and pressure that women feel is almost as significant. I mean, there are still women, even in the Harvey Weinstein's case, who are afraid to come forward. That is also quite a lasting effect. What does that say about how much is left in this battle?
I think that it's clear that, you know, going into 2020, in terms of the Me Too movement, it feels like everything has changed and nothing has changed at the same time. There have been obviously an unprecedented number of women who have come forward with their stories of sexual harassment and abuse. It really feels like there's been a cultural shift. At the same time, there are questions about whether or not there's really systemically anything has changed. And I think that this is going to be a chance to see how the criminal justice stacks up within this Me Too moment.
The answer, almost 4 years to the day since his conviction, appeared to have been yes. But now, well, it's still yes if you define justice as a bad man getting his due, Harvey Weinstein still in prison. If you define it as properly adhering to procedure in which every criminal defendant deserves, the New York Appeals Court, by only a 4-3 margin, said it wasn't a just verdict. And if you were surprised that the trial judge's rulings were found to be on shaky or illegitimate legal ground, I was surprised too. So I went back to see if journalists, if any experts, were contemporaneously questioning the Sandoval rulings, the ability of prior bad act witnesses to be heard from. I found a write-up in The Nation magazine by Joanne Wipicheski, and she wrote, "The media largely characterized the defense argument as an attack on women and sidestepped the vital matter of whether the prosecution had proved its case." She goes on to highlight exactly the prior bad act witnesses, and she also chastises the media for not seeing what she was seeing. Wipicheski took issue with more than just the Sandoval rulings, but her contemporaneous write-up of the trial, which was filed before the verdict, comports with what I'm now beginning to understand really happened. That the entire media narrative can be heard in how Dasha Burns framed her first question to Megan Toohey as the trial started.
What have you seen about how difficult it is to navigate a case like this and to get justice?
Now that's what you asked before a war crimes trial against Milosevic, not an American criminal case which might maybe properly hinge on issue other than the bravery of the victims. And I do think the victims were brave, and I do think the victims were victims. But as with so much else in this country, the moral and ethical issues of Weinstein were flattened to how good we are to have finally caught a monster. And when that's the issue, when shortcuts are not just downplayed, they're not even observed, it's bad for the overall quest for justice. There was a moment when someone could have said, you know, there are some issues here that reverberate beyond Weinstein, that even reverberate beyond this one movement. Less than rigorous application of the principle of when to allow Molyneux witnesses, which are these prior act witnesses, if you're not careful about that, you are committing a literal injustice. And to their credits, the court saw this, I think more than the media did. I'll quote an AP article covering the appeals hearing. This was back in February. Judge Jenny Rivera wondered if the behavior the women described clearly met the high legal bar for allowing additional accusers to take the stand, nearly that their testimony is evidence of the same motive, opportunity, intent, or a common scheme or plan. And Betsy Barrows, who was on the Court of Appeals, appeared alarmed by the judge's ruling allowing prosecutors to confront Weinstein about unrelated behavior. She asked, "How is this a fair trial when you're not able to put in your side of it?" Well, it wasn't a fair trial, and the courts eventually got that right. And the news ran right past that. And justice, defined as something a little grander than finding this defendant guilty or validating this movement, justice, don't worry, we'll get another chance. Prosecutors say they're putting Weinstein back on trial. Also, next month in California, Weinstein's lawyers are set to appeal that verdict. And that's it for today's show. Corey Wara is the GIST producer. Joel Patterson, the GIST senior producer. They're the Quaint Mallards. Michelle Pesca is in charge of special projects for Peachfish Productions. The GIST is presented in collaboration with Libsyn's AdvertiseCast. For advertising inquiries, go to advertisecast.com/thegist. Oompuru-gee-puru-doo-puru. Thanks for listening.